And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, where it is time for the first time in a while to clear our throats and say the three most anticipated words in the history of NBA podcasts recorded in the Grantland 538 studio at Columbus Avenue and 66th Street. What up, Beck?
What up, Zach? I like the fact that there's a new flourish for that intro every time. It's consistent and yet it remains fresh. You find a way to just kind of like give it a little new life each time.
I'm glad because there's only so many things in this burning literally world that we can cling to for joy.
No doubt.
And then that is for me. One of them is seeing your smiling face in your green Banana Republic sweater, which I contemplated buying 2 years ago when it was at Banana Republic, when my wife was like, you need to buy new clothes stat. So it looks nice. Maybe I should have bought it. I didn't buy it.
No, it's a good shade of green. I like it. It's got that. What is this? Is this heathered? Is this marbled? What is this?
I don't know.
Yeah. It looked nice. And by the way, you've got your Grantland jacket or wait, is it a sweatshirt?
It's a hoodie.
It's a zipper hoodie. I was just very pleased. Like the first thing I said when I saw you when I got here was, oh my gosh, the quest is complete. This was a huge thing. This is years long.
And my life is now, there's no way to fulfill it anymore. It's like when the Red Sox finally won the World Series, they just became another baseball team. Now I'm just another guy without a hoodie chase across the world.
Are there some Grantland socks or like Grantland underwear or something that you could still like? There must be some other piece. Like there's got to be one other missing piece.
Speaking of socks, I have a pair of socks that have Larry Bird on them taking a jump shot. And now my daughter knows Larry Bird. So when I wear the socks, she says, oh, there's Larry Bird. And a very proud moment for me the other day, as I continue the tradition of starting this podcast with just complete nonsense, I was watching a game on my laptop and my daughter came over, surely hoping that Dora was playing on my laptop, saw basketball and said, Daddy, where's LeBron?
Wow.
And I was like, all right, baby, wow. You know some stuff now.
My recollection of my daughter's version of that stage, my daughter's way beyond that stage now, coming up on
I met your 13. Daughter. She doesn't care about it. I can tell she doesn't care. She doesn't want to hear about what you do. She is not interested in Steve Ballmer trying to sign you as a free agent.
Although she got a huge kick out of us hanging out with Steve Kerr and his family briefly in Dublin, Ireland, when we had our weird coincidence of being in the same city at the same time halfway around the world. And so my daughter, having seen enough NBA and knowing who these people are and having a definitely strong familiarity with it all, like to her that was a real kick. And Steve Kerr's kids, his adult kids, were very gracious and wonderful to my daughter. There's like she appreciates that. She understands the world that we operate in, and she thinks it's interesting and it's cool. And if I say, hey, you want to go hit a Nets or a Knicks game or something, she's like, yeah, she's into it. But you're right. On that level, like there's a certain disconnect of like, yeah, this is old hat. Dad's just been doing this. But my analogy or my similar experience when she was smaller was that as she started, you know, figuring out who players were, the first name that I think she really latched onto was Dwight Howard. I'm convinced because of my name. But I'm Howard, so she's like,
okay,
so,
all right, okay.
So if she would walk into the room and I'm clicking around her, I've got a game on, and she would walk in. I don't know, she's like 4 or 5 years old. She goes, "Is Dwight Howard in this game?" I recall like that's a specific question she would ask: "Is Dwight Howard in this game?" Yeah, I know. Of all the players for her to have, like,
well, back then he was Superman. He was wearing the cape and winning the dunk contest,
and he was good.
His Q rating was through the roof. Anyway. Well, speaking of Steve Kerr, there is no other place to start other than what is, you know, frankly, no matter how they downplay it, and I don't want to do too much on this because I did it all yesterday, but no matter how much they downplay it, they suspended Draymond Green for nothing short of a tirade directed at Kevin Durant in full view of everyone in the world. And now Mark Spears reports this morning a question I was very curious about. That Draymond may appeal the fine, which is not super unusual. The union doesn't publicize when they appeal these fines that teams issue. It's happened. I know of 3 or 4 incidents in the last, let's say, 3 or 4 years, which means there's certainly triple that probably. But I was very interested to see if he would do it to the point that I texted the union whatever night it became clear, not the next night after the game. When they suspended him because they were on a back to back, I believe, right? Atlanta Clippers. So, hey, you know, you guys can appeal this, right? Like, I just want to double check that you can appeal team. Like, teams just don't have unilateral authority to say, oh, we don't like the words you said. We're taking your game check. And they said, yeah, we're waiting to hear from Draymond and his people. It's always kind of tricky when it's a team thing. And Spears reporting today, like, they might do it. So now I'm on high alert. That would certainly be an interesting little subplot.
Well, you know, this hit me as well the other night whenever the suspension was announced, because my first thought was either there's way more to this, or significantly more, some other piece that we're missing, or they've overreached by a long shot. Because in my experience, my recollection, my memory can be faulty.
And by the way, you're here, A, because I like you, and B, because you wrote the definitive Draymond Green, Steve Kerr, how these guys have, you should look at it, it's from last conference finals on Bleacher Report, how Draymond Green and Steve Kerr have sort of learned to coexist and lift each other up. So I'm very interested to hear your take.
Well, all right, so we'll get to that part of it, because I do think that maybe that the themes that I hit on that story maybe have implications for how this thing goes forward with Draymond and Kevin Durant. But in terms of the suspension, I've pretty much assumed that the union would grieve it, that they would file a grievance, that they would challenge us, because to our knowledge, Draymond said some mean things, maybe some personal things, and certainly went over the line in terms of decorum and good team, being a good teammate and all of this. That's fine, you know, but he's overstepped those bounds before. So have a bazillion other guys, and it doesn't usually result in a one game suspension for conduct detrimental. Now, conduct detrimental to the team is a very vague, broad phrase. And the collective bargaining agreement, obviously allows for a suspension and discipline under that rubric. But you still have to justify it as a team. I don't see how, based on what we know, again, maybe there is some missing piece here. And I suspect there is, especially because the reporting is also that the players themselves endorsed the team's decision to suspend. So maybe there's some other piece. But that's a huge – it feels like an overreach, and it's a lot of money. And, yes, I absolutely expected the union to grieve. But, yeah, it doesn't happen unless, of course, as you note, it's got to come through Draymond and his people to say we want to do this before the union just acts. But To me, it feels like an overreach.
There are lots of people around this, you know, the players, like, I haven't been out there. I'm very jealous of the people who are out there. The players haven't really said anything other than what's been quoted in Marcus Thompson's story and some of the anonymous stuff. But there are people two and three steps away from this who are saying the same thing. Like, there's got to be something more. Some of them heard that there were some other bad words used other than the B word, which has been reported all over the place. I don't really think that changes the question. That answers the question of, like, why now? It could be a case of, it's 13 games in. Let's send a signal now that we're just not going to tolerate this for the rest of the season. And clearly some of it is sending a signal to KD, like, you're important. We love you. This guy hurt your feelings. You're angry. Like, we know you're a free agent. We're not going to say that explicitly. But, you know, we're on your side here. And there is unavoidably the image of, we are taking a side. That is just, like, no matter if you say you're not, no matter if you say we would do it, no matter who was on the other end of the tirade or who gave the tirade. I think it's Draymond specifically that they are always worried about tiptoeing up to that line. It gives that appearance.
It does. And, Tim Kawakami had a great column posted, I think, this morning. I read it on the ride over, that was basically just saying, among other things, that it's basically too simplistic to just say that this is just about them being worried about Durant leaving and trying to send the right signals to him. It's always more than that. And I tend to agree with him there. And you know, nobody's got a better pulse or, you know, finger on the pulse than Tim and some of the guys out in the Bay Area who've been covering this team, you know, day in, day out through a lot of these dramas for several years. I think that is among the unfortunate parts of the action that they took, is that everybody now has to just read into it this way, or that people are naturally going to read into it this way, that this is all about KD's free agency, as opposed to it being about just doing what you need to do to keep a team on track. Or well, to keep a volatile personality like Draymond.
All of those things are entangled with each other. You cannot separate one from the other.
Yeah. But what's more important, I would think, from the Warriors' perspective, and this is a team that, look, we've all praised for their very healthy culture, right? That they do things the right way and they engender a lot of good feelings with each other. And, you know, even when things are tough, you know that this is a team that they look out for each other, right?
Joy, Howard. They play with joy.
They've made joy a thing. They've made joy a thing, but who's...
I thought joy was really a laundry detergent more than anything else, more than like a human emotion.
It's
some sort of detergent. What would happen if you used dishwashing liquid to wash your clothes?
I think you would get a, was it Peter Brady who filled the house with studs when he overdid the...
I feel like that's more of a Bobby thing.
It might have been Bobby Brady. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't remember which Brady boy it was.
I'm not imagining this though, right? There was like a room full
that
of studs.
That happened in a sitcom.
In a room full
Maybe
of studs.
Maybe it was the Brady Bunch.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking it was. I don't recommend...
Alice slacking on the job.
Do not cross up your soaps.
Spending too much time at the butcher shop with Sam.
Well, you know. Sam's
we're
quite
so
the,
old. I am so washed up. Do you know? Now I'm not going to use the Jason Concepcion like falsetto. Do you know what happened to me the other day?
This is how
washed up I am. I took the ferry from Long Island City, where I live, the neighborhood that Amazon is about to ruin, and we're all going to have to flee. We had a good run. It was a nice run.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thanks, Amazon and Mayor De Blasio. It was awesome. Good work, everybody.
Don't forget the governor in this.
And everyone. Great work. Neighborhood's ruined. Took it to Seaport Studio yesterday. It's about 20. Get out my computer to start writing. I look down and I begin typing on the computer, and the waves are going. I'm like, my stomach hurts. Am I getting seasick from the ferry?
Oh no!
Like I grew up on I've been on boats a lot of times. Like I was a swimmer, and like the same thing happens to me in cabs now. Like if I get out in an Uber and I start typing, I get car sick. Yeah. I didn't understand what being car sick was. It's over for me.
I have really disgusting stories of being car sick as a kid that
I didn't understand what it was.
Yeah, no, I have a very acute sense of that, unfortunately.
And here we are making Brady Bunch references for some reason. Please go back to Draymond Green.
There's something else that Tim Kawakami hit on in his column that I thought was very significant, which is that the Warriors have always been the collective. Predating KD, it was strength in numbers. And we can cynically dismiss that as just, you know, cutesy marketing and whatever. But there was something very real to that when they made their first run. Remember, they came what we thought was out of nowhere. They were just a solid playoff team. No one saw the championship run coming. And it wasn't just about Steph Curry being an MVP caliber player. It was about the Splash Brothers. It was about two of them. And it was about Draymond, and it was about Sean Livingston and Andre Iguodala. It was strength in numbers. Like, that was real. When they first did this, before they became an evil empire and a super team, so that mentality or that sense is still with the core group that predates KD, and KD is seeming more and more like the ultimate individualist. Now he joined the collective because that's what he thought he wanted at that time. After this battle of wills to an extent with Russell Westbrook control of the Thunder. But if he's more of just an individualist at the end, then maybe that's what this clash is. That's bigger than just him and Draymond.
I don't even think we – like, I got into this with Kellerman yesterday. Like, I don't really think we know what KD is or what he wants, if he's an individualist, if he's just sort of one of these wayward people who's always unhappy and thinking of another thing, or what he wanted at the end of the game was the ball. But beyond that, you know, the end of the Clippers game. But like, I spent the whole finals trying to figure him out. And like, I was rereading the story I wrote this morning, and I had forgotten some of the stuff in it. Like, I know they were worried middle of the last season that they were kind of losing him. And, like, this is all in the story. Kerr summoned Durant to a lunch, I think in February, and just said, we got to clear the air. And Kerr told me, you know, he tells KD, I don't want to lose you. And then he says to me, he had been drifting a bit. He's vulnerable. He's not a machine. I felt the need to reconnect. Then there's stuff in there about, like, you know, when they go at each other hard in film sessions, like they'll point out mistakes. And there were people on the team who thought that maybe his feelings were hurt, And here's what I wrote. I wrote, Durant withdrew. No one knew exactly why. And here's Bruce Frazier, Q, saying he internalizes things. Sometimes he doesn't say much. It makes you wonder, are you pissed at me? Like, they just don't know what to make of him. And I think around that January, February period of last year when all this stuff is happening, they were like, is he leaving? Like, is he already leaving? Is like, what's up with him? And then it got better and they made the playoffs and blah, blah, blah. But I think they went through a little bit of this last year and that primed them, no matter what they say publicly, to be on high alert this year. And just when the fireworks happen, it all comes out.
Yeah, there's always something lingering below the surface, right? And all of these things matter. That Draymond is a bit of a volatile personality matters. That KD is a little bit of a distant and kind of a cipher. That matters. Like trying all of that stuff comes into play. What's weird about this, Zach, is that if you go back to just the basics of how this thing all started, it was the most like basic, just like stupid basketball argument. Like, you know, you held the ball too long and you punted it away and you should have passed it to me. Like, that could happen in like every game, in every quarter, on every team that has any, like, it's the simplest, dumbest thing. And now it's a 3-day minimum controversy with implications for the future of the Warriors and whether this dynasty will last and all this. And granted, it's because it was never just about the one play. I get that. But it's interesting how that one little sequence, and I think KD overreacting basically in the moment, which then causes Draymond to overreact.
I will say there are people around the team. I don't want to – not on the team. I haven't heard this from players, but people that players talk to that are – apparently people are surprised by how affected KD was. And I don't mean like sad. I mean angry, angry he got.
It doesn't make much sense.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how you would take it. I don't know how I would take it if Draymond Green started yelling at me. I don't know.
No, I'm sorry. I meant the basketball part of it. But yeah, that happens every game. Like, you know, hey, man, pass me the ball. But not an all-out tire. And they hadn't just lost, right? That was right before overtime, correct? If I'm recalling correctly.
Yes, it was end of regulation.
These late games are all ahead.
When Clay was also on fire and probably wanted the ball too.
Right. So guys make mistakes with the ball. It happens. Draymond's also a really great playmaker and a really intelligent player. So, you know, that he had a screw-up in that moment, all right, you know, it happens. But, like, this is a November game. This isn't like – there's nothing on the line here at this moment. So for that play to have triggered that response from KD in the first place, you know, what Draymond might have said and the way it affected him is one thing. This all begins with Draymond making a simple, I would say, innocent may not be the right word, but a simple basketball mistake that KD is irate about. Go back to that. I don't get that. That seems like a bit of an overreaction.
I'd have to watch the play again. I've watched it two or three times. But in my head, I was thinking, KD just got to run hard. Like, Draymond is going to bring the ball up, and he's going to kick it to someone. That's what he does. And if you run the wing hard, he's going to find. And then, of course, he falls over, and whatever happens, happens. But I remember KD clapping and kind of hopping and me saying, A, call timeout. B, run to the wing. He's going to find you. You know, hovering over all of this is that the four stars – all want the max. And there is great skepticism around the league, regardless of what Joe Lacob says and regardless of how this new arena is going to print money. And as Kevin Arnotz wrote in a wonderful story that everyone should read on .com this week, it's not just an arena. They're landlords of a real estate complex. They're going to make money off of that. Like, regardless of all that, there's just a skepticism of, like, are they really going to have a $400 million payroll? Because that's what it is. It's and that's not being extravagant with the mid-level and all that stuff. That's just, it's $350 to $400 million. And the only way to not have that is to not have all four. And obviously Steph stays. I think Clay will get maxed. Clay's not taking a discount. Right now, Clay's not taking a discount. When push comes to shove, maybe he would. I don't think so, because Clay can get a max. Clay can get a max from the Lakers. Clay can get a max from lots of other teams. Whether you think he deserves it or not, he's getting a max. KD is the second best player in the league, the third best player in the league, whatever. Whatever you think he is, he's going to get a max. Obviously, the Knicks would triple max him if they could. Maybe they wouldn't. I don't know. The Knicks are just, if James Dolan is even paying attention to any of this, they're thrilled with everything. This couldn't be playing out better.
Oh no, I'm sure they're giddy at Two Penn Plaza right now.
It just couldn't be playing out better. And that leaves Draymond. And I've had this argument with lots of people around the league. I don't think Draymond gets a max on the open market. And I'm not saying like, I'm saying I don't think he gets the maximum salary for any period of years. Not a 2+1, not a 3+1. I would say 60% of the people I've bounced that off of disagree with me and think he would get a short max, a 2+1 max, a 3+1 max. I love Draymond Green. I've called him the third best player on the Warriors over Clay since this KD era started. I think he is the smartest defensive player and maybe the greatest defense player I've ever seen since Kevin Garnett was in his prime, and maybe even smarter in terms of how his brain processes the game than KG. He's the best passer on the team. There's just no one. People keep saying you can plug and play this guy or that guy. It can be PJ Tucker, can be Draymond Green and Pascal Siakam. No, none of these guys can be Draymond Green right now. None of them. That's how good he is.
Yeah.
None of them. PJ Tucker can't pass and run the break like Draymond Green. He might be able to defend like 80%, 90% of Draymond Green, but the 10% is huge. I just think given his age, the way his shooting has deteriorated, the way his body sort of gets nicked up now and then, and questions about how he will age once he turns 30. And right or wrong, questions about whether he is more a product of the star talent around him. Not more that whether he's Draymond Green without two of the greatest, forget KD. He was Draymond Green before KD came, which I think is part of the issue here.
Yeah.
Whether he's Draymond Green without the two greatest shooters literally in the history of Earth surrounding him. There's a lot of skepticism about that, much like there's a lot of skepticism about will player A function outside of San Antonio, fair or not. I'm just not sure he gets a max. I'm not sure who the team is. I know there are teams that would trade for him now, and I went through the trade machine and started coming up with fake Draymond Green trades, even though the Warriors will not trade him this season unless it's a complete catastrophe.
Yeah.
You know what the most funny trade would be? To the Rockets for PJ Tucker, Brandon Knight, and a bunch of draft picks. You know what I really wish? You know who could use a power forward? I mean, despite the fact that Jeremy Grant is quietly shooting 35% of threes, I wish we could trade him to Oklahoma City. They just have nothing to trade. That would be the most fun trade. It's not going to happen. They're not trading Draymond Green. Not this season.
That your fake trades alone have just set the internet ablaze. He's 29 in March, so he's 30 plus when he hits free agency in 2020. At age 30, for just about anybody, but certainly anybody less than an MVP caliber player, right? He might still be an all-star at age 30, but when you're thinking of 4 or 5 year deals for somebody at that age, almost no matter who they are, unless they're LeBron, KD, Steph, there's a handful of people you don't hesitate to give the max to. I mean, the Rockets are probably already regretting the Chris Paul max.
Well, and I predicted all last year he will not get the 5-year max.
Yeah.
And he didn't.
No.
You know what? I'm going to make another prediction right now. I'm a little more nervous about this one. Jimmy Butler doesn't get the 5-year max from Philadelphia.
Oh, well, I think that's probably true too.
If he gets 5 years, he'll get it a little bit below the max, or he'll get a 3+1 or a 4+1 or something like that.
Yeah. And this is the thing where semantics get in the way here sometimes with these discussions. Like, is the max the full amount you can make over the full number of years with the full raises, or is the max just simply the starting number that the CBA allows and then you play with it from there? But yeah, I agree with you on Jimmy Butler. I think he'll get close. I think he's more likely to get the full max almost if he leaves. Cause somebody will want to go to the absolute, limits to steal him, right? Teams that really need him. The Knicks might really need him if they don't get KD. The Clippers might really need him if they don't get KD or Kawhi. I think it's possible Jimmy Butler does. I think it's different for a guy like Draymond because he's perceived in this way. Like, you know you can build some semblance of a team around Jimmy Butler. He's your starting point. Can you build a team around Draymond Green? That's always been the question here, right? Is he a max player in terms of his value, and especially to the Warriors? Yes. Is he a completely unique player in today's NBA? Yes. Is he all the things that you said he was, brilliant defensively? Yes, and a great playmaker. But we usually think of Max as a guy that you would now build a team around, your first or second best player, and who can create a lot of things. And he can create, but he's going to be 30 when he hits free agency. Now, the wild card in all this is, and I'm with you, I don't think Draymond gets the full Max in 2020. The wild card is, I haven't scoped out, and I don't know if you have, like, all right, and it's impossible to tell, like, who are the teams that are going to have cap room then? Because if you've got two All-Stars and somehow still have a max slot open, and your All-Stars happen to be at positions other than his, okay. Maybe if you think he's the guy that puts you over the top, that's possible. It's going to be so much about context. The team that would give Draymond the max other than the Warriors is the hypothetical team that has like two All-Stars and is one incredible front court defender away from contention.
I'm going to make a radical suggestion. Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
Let's stop talking about the Warriors.
All right, moving on.
Because they're going to win the championship this year. This is like they're so much better than everybody else. And these two guys, even if they hate each other, they are ballers. Like Kevin Durant, if you don't know anything about his personality, the dude is a baller. He loves basketball. He lives to play basketball. Draymond Green lives to win. It's not like they're going to stop passing to each other or helping each other on defense. They're going to be professional and play because that's what you do. Even if you just want to get paid, that's what you do. You don't stop being a teammate. And as long as they're functional teammates for 48 minutes a night, they're just way better than everyone unless Houston somehow recaptures the magic they had last year. There's just no one in the league that can touch them right now.
I'm not really that concerned. I'd be more concerned at the moment that it happened with Steph going down than with the blow up.
It's not even close. It's not even
health. Health.
That's
is still
why
their
we're
biggest
all
obstacle.
Talking about July and next season because the whatever. You mentioned Jimmy Butler. I mentioned Jimmy Butler. Let's spend a few minutes on Jimmy Butler. Do you have thoughts on Jimmy Butler's debut last night for the Philadelphia 76ers? A rollicking win for Terrence Ross in the Fight in Orlando Magic, in which I think the 76ers found every possible way to turn the ball over in the last 90 seconds of the game.
Is last night a moral victory for the Timberwolves and for Karl-Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins? They won and Jimmy lost.
You know, speaking of Andrew Wiggins, Jeremy Grant shooting 35% from three. Small sample. I was just monitoring. Not saying it's a thing. Just noticing it and tipping a little cap at Jeremy Grant. Say, I got my eye on you, Jeremy Grant. Andrew Wiggins is shooting 42% from three. 4 of 9, I think, last night. Something like that. I'm not saying it's a thing. I'm a skeptic. I'm just
tipping.
I'm nodding in Andrew Wiggins' direction, offering him a cup of Tim Hortons, a Tim Hortons ice cap, and saying, "Hey, nice job, Andrew Wiggins. Just watching."
Yeah.
You know how long these moral victories last when you trade a guy and everyone's happy, and then they're like 1 second.
They looked absolutely giddy last night.
I saw
pieces. You know, I was doing my usual terrible thing of flipping around while also trying to deal with emails and things. If nothing else, at least Markelle Fultz is not still artificially weirdly in the starting lineup. It gave them an excuse or a reason, a rationale, to finally end that really awful, painful experiment.
And they played him in a lot of lineups where it was him and like one center and three shooters, or him and four shooters if you count Muscala as a shooting five. Which he essentially is. And boy, I mean, one of the things that jumped out last night is there's just a whole lot of Mike Muscala going on right now and too much Mike Muscala at power forward because they have lost a key player there, and Wilson Chandler's on a minutes limit and all that. The Philly is just a strange team with a point power forward that screws up the positionality of everyone around. Not screws up, but it just makes them hard to track. You want to hear a Jimmy Butler stat that I asked for, and the people at Stats and Info via Second Spectrum got it for me.
Lay it on me.
Jimmy Butler, game one with the Sixers. Season low, 68 dribbles. Season low, 41 touches. Do you want to know his season averages before last night?
Yes.
So, again, 68 dribbles, 41 touches. Season averages as a fully invested member of the Minnesota Timberwolves. 195 dribbles per game, 64 touches per game. There is clearly going to be a feeling out process.
Well, and to his credit, it looked like he wasn't trying to overdo
it. No, he was cutting. He was doing the things where he got called for it down the stretch. He's such a physical cutter. I said this yesterday. He loves to like kind of get into your body, shove you a little bit, and then cut. He's so good at that, and he got called for it once. But he was figuring out ways to get buckets without having the ball. And, you know, you noticed it right away. What's difficult is I don't think their lack of shooting is like fatal, but he'd catch these little backdoor passes from Embiid. and there'd be a defender waiting for him at the rim because Ben Simmons is sitting there at the dunker spot, or Markel Fultz, who spends more time in the dunker spot than any guard in the history of basketball because he can't shoot. But I don't think that's a fatal thing. It's just interesting to watch.
It may not be a fatal thing, but it's been a persistent concern ever since they lost Ilyasova and Bellinelli. And I don't think the concern has gone away. I think it is a concern. Again, they're better having at least broken up the Fultz-Simmons alignment. I don't know how many minutes they spent on the court together last night, if at all.
And they ran a pick and roll a couple of times. That was actually interesting. They ran a Fultz-Simmons pick and roll with three shooters around them at one point. That was interesting.
So I think they have both simplified and complicated things, right? They simplified things by creating a starting lineup that I think makes much more sense on paper. They've complicated things because you do have three guys, including two young guys, who are now all going to be fighting for a little bit of spotlight and shine and touches and shots. And for one night, Jimmy Butler takes 12 shots while Embiid takes 20 and only makes six of them. There's going to be this feeling out period. And, I mean, Simmons barely shot at all last night. We'll see how it evolves. We'll see how welcoming they all truly are to each other, and whether they recognize that this is a really phenomenal opportunity for all of them. But I think when you're a young star in this league, and especially when you're a young duo of stars, you think the world is yours. Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons both. Like, there's already that weird kind of, like, it's not like a simmering tension. It's just they're not exactly arm in arm. So Embiid and Simmons already had a slightly strange dynamic below the surface anyway. And now you throw Jimmy Butler, who Jimmy brings all kinds of stuff with him. So it all bears watching. But yeah, just fundamentally, you nailed it with the Muscala issue. Like Muscala and Wilson Chandler, the always seemingly hurt Wilson Chandler, who had some really nice moments last night.
That dunk on the baseline. Oh, well, okay, Wilson Chandler.
Yeah, like if Wilson, like it's the you know, perennial thing. Like if Wilson Chandler is that guy, if Wilson Chandler is the 3-and-D athletic. You know, but he's, you know, he's had a lot of
injuries,
injuries, cuts, scrapes, abrasions, things over the years. But if he can stay healthy, that's a really nice starting five.
I had something else to say about the Sixers, and now I don't remember what it was.
Was it about Furkan Korkmaz?
No, but I liked that they.
I just like saying that.
Unleash the Furkan.
I like Furkan.
Or uncorked the Korkmaz.
A lot of K's.
They love these guys who can run around screens and shoot. It's actually interesting how many they collect. Like Landry Shamet is a little JJ Redick light, and the Furk man is like a little Landry Shamet light.
Yeah.
And you know who's every time they ding their shooting a little bit with the transaction, JJ Redick is like, "Oh baby, you're going to pay so much money to bring me back again because you can't do." He is JJ Redick running off a Joel Embiid handoff. Is the single most important component of their offense, but probably more important, at least in the half court. In the half court, Simmons transition rushes are up there too. So anyway, I'm not going to overreact to one Philadelphia 76ers game. We'll see how they do. I asked you this before the podcast. Give me your we're rapidly reaching the quarter point of the season. Give me one team that you just can't get a feel for no matter how much you watch them or dig in. Because there's always one or two for me where we get to 20 games and I'm like, man, I have no idea what they are.
It's funny. So when you ask, like, what's your most confusing team? I'm like, that's an interesting thought. Let me see. I'm looking. I'm like, oh, I know. The entire freaking Western Conference outside of the Warriors. Like, the Nuggets had that hot start and then have lost four straight as we tape this. Memphis actually looks good for the moment. Are they actually? Sacramento, the Spurs, Utah, Houston? I'm just confused by everybody at this point.
Well, you have to pick one.
All right, so I'm picking the Jazz.
Okay. I like that pick.
Yeah. The West is confusing as hell right now. I think some of this will pan out the way that we expect, right? Like, Sacramento, I love what's happening, and Kings fans, God knows they deserve some joy after all the torture they've been put through, but that's not going to last. I think we all are confident in saying that. The Clippers, we all thought they'd be, you know, better than expected. We thought they'd be incredibly competitive. I thought they were a playoff team if they were in the East.
I love watching the Clippers.
I still don't think they're a playoff team in the West.
The Clippers are so unpleasant to play against. They play hard.
Yeah.
Everyone is just kind of like, they got these physical, just like, they just got a little nasty to them.
Yeah. They're kind of fun. But look, if you know, when you're looking at the standings right now, there are teams that are on the outside looking in that absolutely we still expect to be in the playoffs. The Jazz among them, Pelicans, Rockets, Spurs. I mean, I had questions about the Spurs before the season started. But
I picked them to miss the playoffs, so.
Yeah.
Didn't feel good about it, but I picked it.
So there's four teams that are below the imaginary line on the ESPN standings there. Actually, it's not an imaginary line. It's an actual line.
It's not the first down line.
There's a line. I can see it.
Yeah.
Those are four teams that should be in. And so some stuff will shake out and things, you know, regression to mean and all that. But Utah's I'm not sure what to make of a team that was number one in defensive efficiency last season that is suddenly 19th.
19th.
And is this the new rules affecting them? Or not new rules, the clampdown on clamping down?
I like that, the clampdown.
I just came up with that. It's not bad. Are they being more affected by that than ever? You know, look, the emphasis on cleaning things up on the perimeter and not being able to body check guys and hug guys and grab and all, freedom of movement, is it affecting them more than other teams?
Well, it's their free throw rate allowed is definitely higher than they want it to be. Let me see where it is now. They're around average. They'd like to be better than that and have been better than that.
I've wondered about this aspect, Zach, that in today's NBA, there was a time when you would say, like, there are some teams that are going to hang their head on offense, but if you're too bad on defense, you're probably going to still be below average. There was always this thing where, like, if you're the Suns, even though the Suns weren't as bad defensively as they were characterized at the time under D'Antoni in those years, it was always this, well, it's nice you have all that firepower, but if you don't play any defense, you're screwed. Okay, fine. And there were teams that hung their head on defense, and we would fetishize defense to the point where we would say, like, you know, if there's this dominant defensive team where, like, people would almost think, like, it doesn't matter that you can't, you know, you don't have an all-star score. You're fine. Because we love toughness, right? We love the teams that dig in and they're gritty and, you know. I think in today's NBA, I don't think you can be a great team if you are all defense, no offense. And the Jazz have a phenomenal offensive force in Donovan Mitchell, but everybody else is just kind of complimentary. Their other all-star is a defense-first guy. And I know in Utah they always protest, oh, you know, Rudy can score. He's not a scorer. He can score, but he's not a scorer.
He can dunk the hell out of the ball.
He can dunk the hell out of the ball. But he's not your go-to option, and he's not going to create on offense, and he's not going to do anything with the ball in his hands other than throw it down. So I have feared in the wake of last year's breakthrough that they're still an offensive piece away, maybe a Gordon Hayward away. You know, they needed that. I know. I'm sorry.
Ooh.
No, look, the point being that if you had a player who was a doesn't have to be a 30-point a game scorer, just has to be somebody who can do multiple things with the ball in his hands, so that it's not all on Donovan Mitchell, because I think too much is on him.
I am not worried about the Jazz. I was a little lower on them than the consensus this year. Like, I didn't think that they were, like, the second-best team in the West or the second-best – maybe the second-best team overall. I thought they would win 50, not 55, maybe 48 again, whatever. So I'm not totally surprised. They're 20th in offense, 19th in defense. Their defense is – I would be, like, absolutely blown away if they didn't finish outside the top seven. If they didn't finish inside the top seven or better, like seventh or better. And I think they're going to have a stretch where they're the best or second best defense in the league for 20 games, and it's starting soon. If you look at the shots they allow all the right kinds of shots. They don't allow threes. They don't allow shots at the rim. Opponents are just shooting well from literally everywhere, especially the mid-range. And if you – Second Spectrum has this thing where they, like – here's what teams should shoot against you based on where the shots are coming from and where the defense is and all that. And here's what they are actually shooting. Utah has the biggest positive gap between those two numbers in the league. Like, teams are out shooting what they should shoot. By the way, sneaky, good defense in terms of what shots they allow. Detroit. I was looking at this last night. Detroit allows the seventh fewest threes as a proportion of opponent shot attempts, the second fewest shots at the rim, the most mid-range shots, period, the most. That's interesting. That's worth monitoring. I mean, Brooklyn has played this math game better than everyone. They're number one in least threes and number two in most mid-rangers. But Brooklyn, this is year two in a row that Brooklyn has just played complete money ball defense. Detroit, that's interesting.
That is.
Didn't see that coming.
Yeah, that is. So the indicators would be that some of this is maybe a little fluky, you're saying? Utah will be...
Yeah, Utah's defense is going to be good. Their defense with Gobert on the floor is awesome. Where they're getting killed is the favors no Gobert minutes, which is just, this just keeps being an interesting subplot for them year after year after year. Is like, do we want those two playing together? How much? Blah, blah. And also, like, I think they're 20th in offense. That'll come up, but I don't think they're a juggernaut on offense. Like, if they told me they finished 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, I'd be like, that's about right. But like, Rubio can't hit anything. Yeah. Mitchell is in a slump. And those two guys take a lot of their shots.
They just have no room for error offensively. All right, so who's your confusing team?
I had two because it's my podcast. I can cheat.
Well, I get the entire West.
I have no idea what the Spurs are. Absolutely none. No matter how many times I watch them, I have zero idea. I don't know what – I mean, I obviously know they take a lot of mid-range shots. They don't turn the ball over. They play slow. Part of it is, okay, Derek White is now back and playing pretty well. DeJounte Murray is not back. Rudy Gay's in and out of the lineup. Pau Gasol's in and out of the lineup. Jakob Poeltl started the season starting and now barely plays. They're just a weird – like, they got blown out last night by Phoenix, did they not?
Last night was nothing but upsets. Like the only games that went to form were the Knicks and Nets losing. Everything else, I think, was technically an upset.
Yeah, they got blown. I just don't know. Defensively, they've struggled, which is not a surprise. I mean, they're playing lineups with four minus defensive players and LaMarcus Aldridge at center. Like, that's a lot of their team.
Yeah, blown out by the Suns is very strange for the Spurs.
So I'm just throwing my, and I've watched the Spurs a fair bit. I'm just throwing my hands up in the air. I need 20 more games to figure out what the Spurs are. They're 7-6 now, I think. So they're, after a start that I didn't quite believe in, they're settling back in at their level. The other team, I don't know how Memphis is doing this. 8-5. Conley and Gasol have not shot the ball well yet. I mean, the only guy having a year where you're like, okay, this is explaining how they're 8-5. They beat the Jazz twice already. Shelvin Mack had a little brief flurry. Is like, is he going to be the sixth man of the year? What in the world has gotten into Shelvin Mack? Even last night against the Bucks, he was making shots when they were ducking under picks against him and stuff. On the one hand, Memphis is 8-5, and I don't believe it. Don't believe in it. They are third in defense, I think, and I don't believe in that. And if you look at how they're third in defense, the shots they allow are not good shots. All the money ball stuff we just talked about is not them. And teams are shooting, I think, a little bit unsustainably low against them, but not much. They walk into every game with an advantage of five turnovers. They force like 18 a game and turn it over 13 a game. And they're winning the foul game every night. Though that's what's keeping them kind of afloat on defense. And I'm just not sure that they can keep that up. Teams are also randomly shooting horribly from the line against them. There are all these like little indicators that are like, I'm not that third ranking in defense. I just don't believe at all.
Yeah.
However, their two best players have not shot it well, and that will change presumably at some time. So I'm skeptical. I don't think they are a playoff team. But they just find ways, you know, between weird losses to the Suns, they find ways. And I tell you, I like watching Jaren Jackson Jr. That dude is smooth. On defense, he is just smooth. He moves really well. He stays down. He's long. He doesn't ever get out of control. Doesn't ever rush. Doesn't ever hurry. But he's a player.
No, there are actually things to like about them right now. I'm forever fascinated by the fact that Marshawn Brooks, who was like the poor man's Nick Young for the Nets back in the day or something. He was like the poor man's something. He's averaging 14 minutes a game for the Grizzlies.
Speaking of which, Wayne Seldon is playing power forward because literally all their power forwards are injured. Like, other than Jaren Jackson Jr., who starts at the four and then plays the five. Jamichael Green's injured. Omri Caspi's missed a couple of games. Chandler Parsons, I feel bad for Chandler Parsons. Yeah. His body is broken. Just no more Players Tribune essays about how this is the year it's going to happen. Because it took three games, and now he's just out. And he's just sore. He's out with soreness. I feel bad for him. It's not his fault that his body is broken, but it's broken.
No. It's the Grizzlies' fault for giving him that contract, knowing that he was coming off of a couple of serious knee surgeries. This is what kills me. Like, I wish fans would direct their anger in the right place with these things, especially when it was an obvious, massive risk. Don't blame the player for being hurt. It's not like he's not trying to be healthy. Blame the team for making a really colossally stupid bet.
Do you have any other thoughts on the Grizzlies? I watch them and I'm like slow-mo's not having a good season. Yeah. Garrett Temple, whatever he's shooting, it's not like it's great and he shoots a lot. Like, I just don't understand, other than Shelvin Mack going crazy for a little bit off the bat. Like, Garrett Temple shooting 39% from
shot
three.
Who did he have a big shot against the other night? There was something. I saw there was a Garrett Temple highlight a couple nights ago. So, I got nothing else on the Grizzlies for you.
I'm trying to think if there's any other teams that you mentioned. You got all Western Conference teams. The Heat, the East is strangely just sort of, no one is super interesting in the East. Like, the Cavs, Hawks, Knicks, and Bulls are really, really bad. The Wizards, for all the rigmarole, are one game out of the playoffs. And I still think on talent, if they don't make the top eight in the freaking East, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
They should make the top eight in the East.
I think they will.
Brooklyn is 6-9. They just lost their best player for a while. Miami scuffling a little bit, but 2-under. Orlando at 7-8, I think, is maybe a slight surprise, especially considering they don't have the scoring margin of a 7-8 team. Everyone else is kind of like, I get Boston is the only one. Boston is the one where you're like, okay, that's a little weird. They're 8-6. Their point differential is actually pretty good. Their offense has the same problems it's had for 2 years now. They don't get to the rim. They don't get free throws, yada, yada, yada. They are aware of that and hopeful that it will nudge in the right direction, but they're number one or two in defense. Like, they'll be a good team, a really good team soon. The East is kind of like whatever.
Yeah, no, it's about where it should be, right? Milwaukee with the hot start and like they're a bit of a revelation, right? Like, I think I said this to you in notes before the pod. Like, I felt like the Bucks, I wasn't sure what kind of advancement we should actually expect this year, having not made any significant personnel changes in terms of the roster itself, right? Oh, yeah, adding Brook Lopez is fine, adding some shooting is fine, but they still didn't have that second star. Stars matter in this league a lot, and Giannis doesn't have that go-to reliable Robin to his Batman or whatever dumb superhero analogy you want to create for it. So their biggest pickup was their coach, and as it turns out, so far, 14 games in, that's mattered a lot because they're playing a smarter style that's getting them better shots, and they're taking a ton of more threes, and they're making them, and Giannis has more room to drive, and it's early still. I don't know that Milwaukee's really going to be a top two team in the East, but I think early on, this is one of those interesting cases of, like, maybe, you know, this is proof for anybody who wants to emphasize the importance of a coach. The Bucks are a great case right now.
The buzz when Brook Lopez winds up like a 29-foot three is awesome in the Fiserv forum.
I don't know how they pronounce that. I assume Fiserv. Fiserv doesn't seem right, right?
Fiserv, you know what they should, they should say when the Bucks win, it should go up on the scoreboard. You got served. That's what they should do.
You didn't just get served. You got Fiserv.
Yeah. Own their terrible arena name.
That's a bad name.
I was in Portland last week. It really, in person, you just feel even more how terrible it is that the arena is called the Moda Center. Like, just seeing the word and blaring lights, it's like just an ugly word. It's like one of those words, like Moda, just sounds.
It doesn't
bad.
It sounds muddy. It doesn't come off the tongue well. Like, it sounds like a transit hub.
Or like, I feel like I gotta, I'm coming down with Moda. I gotta go see a doctor. I got a Moda infection, right? It's just like, I feel like I'm a little Moda today.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Moda Center. If you are looking for the train to Northampton, you please go to gate number one.
I mean, it sounds like a transit hub.
Don't like it. Rose Garden.
It's always the Rose Garden. It will forever be the Rose Garden.
Okay, very important question for you. What are your favorite and least favorite City Edition jerseys now that they're all out?
Oh. So this was an interesting one to ponder as I was looking at these.
I ponder.
I had an editor way back early in my career who, in assessing my deliberateness of things, sometimes she says, "You are one who ponders."
I feel like the Buddha is one who ponders. You're like the Buddha.
I am no Buddha. So it's funny. I was trying to narrow it down, right? I wanted to pick one. Like, what's the best of the best?
You got to pick one. You got to really just pick one. I like a lot of them, but you got to pick one.
All right. There's a premise here. So I'm going to explain. So I when I decided to pick one, it was Denver. And it was
it's a beautiful jersey.
But the Denver one I had to pick from among my three, which was Denver, Minnesota, and Miami. Now, Miami has the Miami Vice-inspired jerseys. Minnesota's got the Prince-inspired Purple Rain script jerseys. And then there's the Nuggets, and all of a sudden it hit me like, holy shit, I'm stuck in the 80s. Here I am, the old man stuck in the 80s.
Washed up, baby.
What? I can't do it like Concepcion
either. Don't do it. Yeah, don't even try.
Only Jason Concepcion should do it. Shout out to Network. It's fun. I did not deliberately do this, but I glanced down at the page after like kind of making some notes to myself about what did I like, not like, and it's all the 80s rooted nostalgia jerseys. Note on the Denver Nuggets thing. So first of all, the Athletic, I'm trying to remember the name of the reporter who did it, who went and found the guy who designed those old 80s.
Nick Kosmider, I think.
Yes. Phenomenal story by him. Great job finding the guy, the artist who created that iconic jersey for the Nuggets back then. I remember thinking back then, at the time those Nuggets jerseys were their jersey, it always struck me that rainbow alignment combined with the blockiness of it, these chunks out of it, whatever, to mimic the skyline in the mountains, it always reminded me of, like, here we go, old man again, the 1980s Atari breakout game. So, folks, like, Google especially.
I never had an Atari. I'm, like, right at the age where you maybe didn't have an Atari. So that's the age gap with us right there. It's symbolized by Atari. Some of my friends had Atari, but it wasn't universal the way, like, everyone got Nintendo.
Yeah.
Nintendo was the one that you got.
You skipped right past the ColecoVision.
Oh, I don't even know what. I mean, I'm aware that that was a thing. I don't even know.
I'm really dating myself. Google, so to the kids, go to your Google machines and Google Atari Breakout and look at that color pattern and with the blocks out, because Breakout was all about knocking out pieces of these colored bars, these rainbow bars, and it's very reminiscent of what the Nuggets jersey was back then and that they have now revived with their city jersey. So, yes, my top three and my number one of the city jerseys somehow are all just rooted in the 80s. I'm not sure what that says about me other than I'm old.
So I really wanted to have a creative answer to this question. The answer is the Heat jersey. It's just so good.
It's really good.
And they're going to cycle through every iteration of this possible until they're done, which is what they should do. They landed on a good thing. They should just keep doing it. I even like the court. Have you seen the court?
Yes.
The court is awesome.
Yeah.
I don't know how you play against them.
It's distracting.
It's a good strategy. It's too – and then they start wearing the turquoise sneakers and the pink sneakers some of the guys wear, and it's like, I don't know. I couldn't play. It's the best one. I'm sorry that it's not a creative answer. It's just awesome, and it's just awesome. It's so fantastic to look at. The Nuggets one is great. The Heat one, I mean, I like a lot of them, but it's just – I'll tell you what one that I like that is subtle. The Boston one with the gold outlining of the letter, which harkens back again to the 80s where yellow or whatever was like in their palette a little bit before it got eased out. I like that one. Okay, what's the worst one?
Real quick, shout out to – this was my honorable mentions. I like the Blazers. I like the Nets. That's an easy one.
Yeah.
I like the Laker one. I like that weird different purple.
Have you seen it up close?
I have not.
It has, like, I can't remember what it has on it, like those black stripes that you can kind of
make. Oh, yeah, very subtle. You can see it on TV.
They're words, though. They're like tiny little words. Like, I don't know if it's names of players that Magic played with or something. It's something like that.
And then the Clipper one, because another, here I go again, that LA thing with the little lines that looks like it's like moving or whatever, is just a little reminiscent of the LA Express of the USFL.
It's terrible. The Clippers are terrible. Everything they do is like a knockoff of something else.
They really
They're like all their art is just like Walmart art. It's terrible.
I just liked it because it was reminiscent of the LA Express of the USFL.
I agree,
shout
but
out
it's,
to Jeff Pearlman.
It's terrible.
The worst. I had three, and then I had to pick one again.
Okay.
So my bottom three were in no particular order at this point. The Thunder, the
Bucks.
The Bucks and the Kings. Now people are going to people are going to clap back at the Kings one.
Howard Beck, I am shocked.
Yeah.
I am shocked.
Shocked at the fact that I put the Kings on there or that I missed somebody entirely that
should
have been there.
I just didn't think any of those were that like super objectionable.
All right, so here's the thing, Zach. The Kings one, it's that powder blue from their worst era, that early, the 80s and early 90s Kings. And I was living out there at that time, right? I went to UC Davis. I was there when the more or less that same time frame when the Kings arrive. Those powder blue, all I can think of is like Purvis Ellison being miserable that he was even drafted by the Kings. A lot of really just forgettable players, a terrible team playing in a terrible building in the middle of a field. I don't understand. Like, I understand people have an affinity for the look and that color. I don't know that anybody should want to evoke any memories of what it was a colossally awful time in their franchise history.
Well, I see, I admire them doing it anyway because a lot of these teams just do the nostalgia thing for like, oh, the team was good then, so everybody likes this, even if it's like an uninspired color or logo or whatever. So let's bring it back because we were good. So like, I admire them being like, we were terrible, but we still like this thing. It's still part of our history. Let's bring it back. I like powder blue. I'm a sucker for powder blue.
And I'm not a powder blue guy either. That's part of it. I admit it.
So what was your actual choice for the worst?
I decided to go with the Kings. Don't remind me of Purvis Ellison.
I'm just shocked.
Just don't remind me of Purvis Ellison. I just, you know, I think that's fair.
I'm not going to reveal my actual worst one because it's in my column. It's one of the things in the 10 things. However, I will say that among the candidates were the Spurs. I'm done with the camouflage. Do something else.
Yeah.
Do something. Bring back the Fiesta colors. Do something. Silver and black is cool, but just like, give me something. Think about it. Put more than 5 seconds of thought into like, oh, we're doing camouflage again. Just give me some evidence that you care.
Isn't it just like the Spurs to say, oh, you want us to do something fancy and cool and what? No, that's too.
Three passes before you shoot. Run the picket fence.
By the way,
run it again. Get it right.
Camouflage is intentionally ugly. Like there's not camouflage is just an ugly. Creation in general. Just because you turn it into black and gray or whatever doesn't make it any more. It's just not pleasant to look at.
Also, putting no effort into the entire exercise, the Phoenix Suns who just roll out the purple low Suns jersey again.
Yes.
Just thought, no cares.
Negative points for lack of creativity. That one just, like, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just, it just shows a complete lack of initiative on their part.
And also in contention, the black Buzz City jerseys. Just that's what you do when you're like, everyone kind of likes our teal. Black seems to be popular. So how about we just do that? Like this, there's no, at least the Pistons have like a little tire tread or road or whatever in their black one. And, the Heat's black one is awesome anyway. And there's another black one, like even the Mavericks black-ish one, it's kind of grayish black is all right by their standards.
It's like, sharp.
It's all right, but the Magic at least have a cool logo on their black. The Charlotte black one is just totally uninspired.
Can I tell you my problem with the Bucks one?
Yes.
I was thinking about this for a while. Well, first of all, I just think it's just ugly. The there's no cool logo. There's no cool script. There's no one thing about it that you think that is just feels this, you know, aesthetically or artistically original or pleasing. Here's the main problem I think I have with it. It is a massive swatch of yellow. Bright yellow with a patch of red, which every time I see anything even close to that just reminds me of Ronald McDonald. Like, this is a McDonald's outfit. This is like this is the city jersey for the guy making the fries. Like, this is if McDonald's were to do nostalgia uniforms to try to get their customers to buy McDonald's jerseys to go with their hot apple pie, they would go with the Bucks city jersey. You can't do, first of all, the best thing about the Bucks, current, jersey, their color scheme, everything else, the Buck itself, the logo is freaking awesome. And that Agreed. Dark green, that forest green, whatever they've called their green, I'm going to call it forest green, is just, it's a really cool green. It's great, and it's evocative of where Bucks are in the forest. Bright yellow is evocative of the fryer at McDonald's. Where's the bright yellow coming from?
It's a really strong take. I didn't see this coming.
And I like the Bucks, a great organization.
It's definitely the most polarizing jersey. They actually had them. They played in Portland last week. They actually brought a couple to their shoot around to show people. They look better in person than they do in this image, which sounds weird to say, but they look the same. But feeling them and looking at them, they look a little better.
Along with my powder blue problem, I also have like a mustard yellow problem. Like the Lakers jersey this year is this weird brighter yellow. Do you have any insight into this? Do you have any intel on it's not my TV. My TV has not changed. The Lakers yellow looks yellower. And the Nuggets.
I don't have intel on
that. The Nuggets have had that brighter yellow alt jersey that bright yellow just burns my eyes. I don't need it. Especially if your primary color is a really cool forest green.
Howard Beck coming strong with the jersey stuff. Wow. Just really, I'm going to have to. Wow. Anyway, Draymond Green is actually going to speak to the media shortly at Warriors shootaround. I'm just saying that to make clear we said all this before the Warriors emerged to the world today.
Before we go and before we leave the world of minutiae, but minutiae that both of us care deeply about, have you gotten any explanation at all as to what the fuck the Nets did? What the fuck the Nets did about the baseline fiasco.
So for those who don't know, which the normals listening, the Nets had this wonderful subway tile mosaic motif along their baseline where the word Brooklyn was rendered in white letters on a black baseline.
Brilliant.
And it was just as locally evocative. It was like a New York subway thing. And suddenly and unexpectedly, before the season, they unveiled this new thing that is just says Brooklyn in white letters, and there's no mosaic, there's no nothing. It's just a font that could exist literally anywhere. It's clearly a dumb idea. And I can tell you this, it happened very late in the process. The explanation I got was it's somehow the font is in their Brooklyn We Go Hard font. It's the same font, or it's somehow connected to their slogan, hashtag, whatever it is these teams do now where they all have to have the same hashtag. The team has to hashtag everything with Brooklyn Go Hard or We Go Hard. It's the same font. It's somehow connected to that, or they wanted to have, you know, the branding people, we have to have brand synergy. We have to do the influencers and all the brand synergy and all these made up gobbledygook that they say. So it's something related to that. And it's a terrible idea and someone should get fired. I wouldn't say someone should get fired. It's just a bad idea.
They overthought this. They happened upon or chose or smartly decided on something very, very cool and unique and evocative of their home market, and it was brilliant, and they got wide praise for it, and they scrapped it. Like, why would you do that?
It's one of those things where, like, I'm not sure how you can have, like, let's just make up a number, like 8 human beings in a room, and this idea is brought up, like not one of them said, this is dumb. Yeah. It's like when Simmons used to talk about device being the VP of common sense for a team.
Yeah.
That's what he said. It's like, no one said this was dumb. Like, not one person in the room was like, we have this cool thing, everyone likes it, and the other thing sucks. Like, why don't we not do it?
Yeah. I mean, probably it's not going to be the difference between whether or not they get Kawhi and KD next summer or not. But if those guys objected to the change on the baseline as like, this is a
I'll
sign
tell you
of
right
an organization's
now,
not
if, I were if I were a superstar NBA player and I went to meet with the Nets, it would be like my fourth question if I wanted to go to the Nets.
By the way,
it would be like,
by the way,
I'd ask about Caris LeVert and Kenny Atkinson and like, you know, is there a cool place I can live in Brooklyn? And then I would ask like, who's in charge of this decision?
Yeah.
Why did this happen?
Yeah.
And if my answer was not satisfactory,
yeah,
or if the answer did not satisfy me, I don't think I would sign with the Knicks. But I would sign with somebody else.
I'd go to the Clippers, maybe.
Yeah. It would be important to me. Now, the Clippers are, as a condition of signing there, I would demand in my contract that I get to advise on the rebrand of the Clippers that is inevitably going to come, whether they move or whenever it's going to happen. I need a say in that because their stuff is a disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially all the logos, all the branding stuff, all that. They need a whole complete rethinking of that. But
this is what I would care about.
Yeah.
All right, Howard Beck, you can read all this stuff on Bleacher Report, including last week he released a wonderful piece on the Clippers where Steve Ballmer declared his intentions to be a free agency player and why players should go there and swept Howard Beck off his feet almost. Howard Beck was ready to sign up and be a defensive specialist for the Clippers. It's a really, really fun story. Talk to the logo, talk to everybody. So go read that. Listen to the full 48. Who'd you have this week? You had RJ last week, right?
RJ was fantastic. Grant Hill is the one that's up right now.
Ooh.
Coming Monday.
Big hitters, Howard Beck.
Teaser, coming Monday.
I have to settle for Howard Beck.
Coming Monday, Michael Rapoport. You do not want to miss this
one. Oh, boy.
We recorded yesterday. It's the man's on fire. I think the studio is actually scorched.
Well, listen for that one. Howard Beck, thanks for coming on, as always. We love reading your stuff, and everyone should check it out.
Thanks, Zach.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.